I have a son, and what I said to him, and what he said to me, is the crux of the matter. He asked me a question. Well, in my opinion, it was a kind of question that's at the bottom of most of the world's troubles today, where there are some sleeping dogs that should just be left to lie. There are some questions that should not be asked.
It's the COI Podcast.
Hello from Brooklyn. I'm Sergey Burbank, Coordinating Director of Conflict of Interest Theater Company. The COI Podcast combines a love of literature with a love of performance, and for the next few episodes, we'll show that love even more than before as we present live recordings of the COI Podcast presented before an audience. In the summer of 2010, the COI Podcast presented live recording sessions over the course of four evenings as part of the Bococca Arts Festival at the Archip Gallery Theater in Brooklyn. We've never recorded the podcast outside the COI Podcast Central, so this was an experiment. You'll notice some rough aspects to the audio, everything from creaking chairs, echoing voices, and street-level traffic. Our performers and audiences rolled with it and had a great time. I invite you to do the same for the same effect. Stanley Ellen was an American mystery writer born in Brooklyn, New York. He was awarded three Edgar Allan Poe Awards. Several episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents were based on Ellen's short stories, and his novels Dreadful Summit, House of Cards, and The Bind were adapted into feature films. James Bentley's acting credits include The Polish Play, Swallow, A Midsummer Night's Dream, Dissatisfaction No. 4, and The Garden Party. A graduate of Bennington College, Bentley appeared in COI's production of The Third Seat as part of the inaugural Bococca Arts Festival. Here's James Bentley performing The Question by Stanley Ellen.
I am an electrocutioner. I prefer this word to executioner. I think words make a difference. When I was a boy, people who buried the dead were undertakers. And then somewhere along the way, they became morticians. And they are better off for it. Take the one who used to be the undertaker in my town. He was a decent, respectable man, very friendly, if you'd let him be. But hardly anybody would let him be. Today, his son, who now runs the business, is not an undertaker, but a mortician. And he is welcome everywhere. As a matter of fact, he's an officer in my lodge and is one of the most popular members we have. And all it took to do was changing one word to another. The job's the same, but the word is different. And people somehow will always go by words rather than meanings. So, as I said, I am an electrocutioner, which is the proper professional word for it in my state, where the electric chair is the means of execution. Not that this is my profession, actually it's a sideline, and it is for most of us who perform executions. My real business is running an electrical supply and repair shop, just as my father did before me. When he died, I inherited not only the business from him, but also the position of state's electrocutioner. We established a tradition, my father and I. He was running the shop profitably even before the turn of the century, when electricity was a comparatively new thing. And he was the first man to perform a successful electrocution for the state. It was not the state's first electrocution, however. That was an experiment and was badly bungled by an engineer who installed the chair in the state prison. My father, who had helped install the chair, was the assistant at the electrocution, and he told me that everything that could go wrong that day did go wrong. The current was eccentric. His boss froze on the switch, and the man in the chair was alive and kicking at the same time he was being burnt to a crisp. The next time, my father offered to do the job himself. He rewired the chair and handled the switch so well that he was offered the job of official electrocutioner. I followed in his footsteps, which is how a tradition is made, but I am afraid this one ends with me. I have a son, and what I said to him, and what he said to me, is the crux of the matter. He asked me a question. Well, in my opinion, it was a kind of question that's at the bottom of most of the world's troubles today, where there are some sleeping dogs that should just be left to lie. There are some questions that should not be asked. To understand all this, I think you have to understand me. Nothing could be easier. I'm 60, just beginning to look my age, a little overweight, suffer sometimes from arthritis when the weather is damp. I'm a good citizen, complain about my taxes, but pay them on schedule. I vote for the right party and run my business well enough to make a comfortable living from it. I've been married 35 years and never looked at another woman in all that time. Well, looked, maybe, but no more than that. I have a married daughter and a granddaughter almost a year, and the prettiest, smilingest baby in town. I spoil her and don't apologize for it, because in my opinion, that is what grandfathers were for, to spoil their grandchildren. Let Mama and Papa attend to the business. Grandpa is there for the fun. And beyond all that, I have a son who asks questions, the kind that shouldn't be asked. But the picture together, and what you get is someone like yourself. I might be your next door neighbor. I might be your old friend. I might be the uncle you meet whenever the family gets together at a wedding or a funeral. I'm like you. Naturally, we all look different on the outside, but we can all still recognize each other on sight as the same kind of people. I mean, deep down inside, where it matters, we have the same feelings, and we know that without any questions being asked about them. But, you may say, there is a difference between us. You're the one who performs the executions, and I'm the one who reads about it in the papers. And that's a big difference. Well, no matter. Is it? Well, look at it without prejudices. Look at it with absolute honesty, and you'll have to admit that you are being unfair. Let's face the facts. We're all in this together. I'm an old friend of yours. If an old friend of yours happens to serve on a jury that finds a murderer guilty, you don't lock the door against him, do you? I mean, more than that, if you could get an introduction to the judge who sentences that murderer to the electric chair, you'd be proud of it, wouldn't you? You'd be honored to have him sit at your table. I mean, you'd be quick enough to let the world know about it. And since you're so willing to be friendly with the jury that convicts and the judge that sentences, what about the man who has to pull the switch? He's finished the job you wanted done. He's made the world a better place for it. Why must he go hide away in a dark corner until the next time he's needed? There's no use denying that nearly everybody feels he should, and then there's less use denying it. I mean, it's a cool thing for anyone in my position to face. If you don't mind some strong language, it's a damn position to face. If you don't think it's an unpleasant job, well then, despise him for the outrage. Sometimes it's hard to abide by such righteousness. I mean, how did I get along in the face of it? The only way possible, by keeping my secret locked up tight and never being tempted to give it away. I don't like it that way, but I'm no fool about it. I mean, the trouble is that I'm naturally easygoing and friendly. I'm the sociable kind. I like people. I want them to like me. At lodge meetings or in the clubhouse, down at the golf course, I'm always at the center of the crowd. And I know that what would happen if at any such time I ever opened my mouth and let the secret out. A 5-minute sensation. And after that, the slow chill setting in. It would mean the end of my whole life, then and there. The kind of life I want to live. And no man in his right mind throws away 60 years of his life for a 5-minute sensation. You can see I've given the matter a lot of thought. Well, more than that, it hasn't been idle thought. I don't pretend to be an educated man, but I'm willing to read books on any subject that interests me, and execution has been one of the main interests ever since I got into the line. I have the books sent to the shop, you know, where nobody takes notice of another piece of mail. I keep them locked in a bin in my office so that I can read them in private. There's a nasty smell about having to do it this way. My age, you know, you hate to feel like a kid hiding away to read a dirty magazine. But I have no choice. There isn't a soul on earth outside of the warden at State's prison and a couple of pick guards there who know I'm the one pulling the switch at the execution. And I intend for it to remain that way. Oh yes, well, my son knows. He's difficult in some ways, but he's no fool. If I wasn't sure he would keep his mouth shut about what I told him, I wouldn't have told him in the first place. Have I learned anything from these books? Yeah, at least enough to take in pride in what I'm doing for the state and the way I do it. As far back to history as you want to go, there have always been executioners. Okay? The day that men first made laws to help keep peace among themselves was the first day an executioner was born. I mean, there have always been lawbreakers, and there must always be a man punishing them. It's that simple. The trouble is that, well, nowadays, there's too many people who don't want to be as simple as that. I'm no hypocrite. I'm not one of those narrow-minded fools who thinks that every time a man comes up with a generous impulse, he's some kind of a crackpot. But he can be mistaken. I put most of the people who are against capital punishment in that class. They are fine, high-minded citizens who never in their lives have been close enough to a murderer or rapist to smell the evil in him. In fact, they're so fine and high-minded that they can't imagine anyone in the world not being like themselves. Okay, in that case, they say anybody who commits murder or rape is just plain, ordinary human being who's had a bad spell. He's no criminal. He's just sick. He doesn't need the electric chair. All he needs is a kindly old doctor to examine his head and straighten out the kinks in his brain. Well, in fact, they say there is no such thing as a criminal at all. There are all only well people and sick people, and the ones who deserve all your worry and consideration are the sick ones. If they happen to murder or rape a few, well, what's one now and then? They just run for the doctor. This is the argument from beginning to end, and I'd be the last one to deny that it's built on honest charity and good intentions. But it's a mistaken argument. It omits the one fact that matters. When anyone commits murder or rape, he is no longer in the human race. A man has a human brain and a God-given soul to control his animal nature. And when the animal in him takes control, he's not a human being anymore. Then he has to be exterminated. The way any animal must be if it goes wild in the middle of a helpless people. My duty is to be the exterminator. I mean, it could be that people just don't understand the meaning of the word duty anymore. I don't want to sound old-fashioned, God forbid, but when I was a boy, things were a lot more straightforward and clear-cut. You learned to tell right from wrong. You listened to do what had to be done, and you didn't ask questions every step of the way. Or if you had to ask any questions, the ones that mattered were, you know, how and when. Then along came psychology. Along come the professors, and the main question was always, why? Ask yourself why, about everything you do, and you'll end up doing nothing. Let a couple of generations go along the way, and you'll finally have a breed of people who sit around in trees like monkeys scratching their heads. Does this sound far-fetched? Well, it isn't. Life is complicated, okay? All of this life, a man finds himself facing one situation after another, and the way to handle them is to live by the rules. Ask yourself why once too often, and you can find yourself so tangled that you go under. The show must go on. Why? Women and children first. Why? My country, right or wrong. Why? Never mind your duty, just keep asking why, until it's too late to do anything about it. Around the time I first started going to school, my father gave me a dog. A collie. It was a pup named Rex. A few years later, Rex suddenly became unfriendly, the way a dog will sometimes, and then vicious. And then one day, he bit my mother. When she reached down to pat him, the day after that, I saw my father leaving the house with his hunting rifle under his arm and with Rex on a leash. It wasn't the hunting season. So I knew what was going to happen to Rex, and I knew why. But it's forgivable in a boy to ask things that a man should be smart enough not to ask. Where are you taking Rex? I asked my father. Where are you going? What are you going to do with him? I'm taking him out of the back, my father said. I'm going to shoot him. But why? I said. And that's when my father let me see that there is only one answer to such a question. Because it has to be done. I never forgot that lesson. It came hard. For a while, I hated my father for it, but as I grew up, I came to see how right he was. We both knew why the dog had to be killed. Beyond that, all the questions would lead nowhere. Why the dog had become vicious? Why God had put a dog on earth to be killed this way? These are questions that you can talk till the end of time about. And while you're talking about them, you still have a vicious dog on your hands. It is strange to look back and realize now that when the business of the dog happened, and long before it, and then long after it, my father was an electrocutioner. And I never knew it. Nobody knew it, not even my mother. A few times a year, my father would pack his bag and a few tools and go away for a couple of days, but that was all any of us knew. I mean, if you asked him where he was going, he'd simply say he had a job to do out of town. He was not a man you'd ever suspect of philandering or going off on a solitary drunk, so nobody gave it a second thought. It worked the same way in my case. I found out how well it worked when I finally told my son what I had been doing all those jobs out of town, and that I had gotten the warden's permission to take him on as an assistant and train him to handle the chair himself when I retired. I could tell from the way he took it that he was thunderstruck. Thunderstruck at this, as I had been 30 years before when my father had taken me into his confidence. Electrocutioner, said my son. An electrocutioner? Well, there's no disgrace in it, I said. And since it's got to be done and somebody has to do it, why not keep it in the family? If you knew anything about it, you know it's a profession that's often passed down in a family from generation to generation. What's wrong with a good, sound tradition? If more people believed in tradition, you wouldn't have so many troubles in the world today. It was the kind of argument that would have been more enough to convince me when I was his age. What I hadn't taken into account was that my son wasn't like me, much as I wanted him to be. He was a grown man in his own right, but a grown man who had never settled down to his responsibilities. I'd always kept closing my eyes to that. I'd always seen him the way I wanted to and not the way that he was. You know, he left college after a year. I said, all right, there are some people who aren't made for college. I never went there, so what difference does it make? When he went out with one girl after another and could never make his mind to marrying one of them, I said, well, he's young, he's sowing his wild oats. The time will come soon enough when he's ready to take care of the home and the family. When he sat daydreaming in the shop instead of tending the business, I never made a fuss about it. I knew when he put his mind to it, he was as good an electrician as you could ask for, and in these times, people are allowed to do a lot more dreaming and a lot less working than they used to. The truth was that the only thing that mattered to me was being his friend. For all his faults, he was a fine-looking boy with a good mind. He wasn't much for mixing with people, but if he wanted to be, he could be anyone. And in the back of my mind, all the while he was growing up, as the thought that he was the only one who would learn my secret someday and would share it with me. And make it easier to bear. I'm not secretive by nature. A man like me needs a thought like that to sustain him. So when the time comes to tell him, he shook his head and he said no. I felt that my legs had been kicked out from under me. I argued with him, and still he said no, and I lost my temper. Are you against capital punishment? I asked him. You don't have to apologize if you are. I think that all the more for you if you are. It's just, I just want to know the reason. I don't know if it is, he said. Well, you ought to make up your mind one way or the other, I told him. I'd hate to think you were like every other hypocrite around who says it's all right to condemn a man to the electric chair and all wrong to pull the switch. Do I have to be the one to pull it, he said. Do you? Somebody has to do it. Somebody always has to do the dirty work for the rest of us. It's not like the Old Testament days when everyone did it for himself. And do you know how they executed a man in those days? They laid him on the ground, they tied his hand and foot, and everybody around had to heave large rocks on him until they crushed him to death. Now, they didn't invite anybody to stand around and watch. I mean, you wouldn't have much of a choice then, would you? I don't know, he said. And then because he was as smart as they come, and he knew how to turn your words against you, he said, after all, I'm not without sin. Don't talk like a child, I said. You're without the sin of murder and any kind of sin that calls for execution. And if you're so sure the Bible has all the answers, you might remember that you're supposed to render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Well, he said, in this case, I'll let you do the rendering. I knew then and there, in the way that he said it, the way he looked at me, that it was no use trying to argue with him. The worst of it was knowing that we had somehow moved far apart from each other and would never really be close again. I should have had some sense enough to let it go at that. I should have told him to forget the whole thing and keep his mouth shut about it. Maybe if I had ever considered the possibility of his saying no, I would have done it. But because I hadn't considered any such possibility, I was caught off balance. I was too much upset to think straight. I will admit it now. It was my own fault that I made an issue of things and led him to the one question he never should have asked. I see, I told him. It's the same old story, isn't it? Let somebody else do it. But if they pull your number out of a hat and you have to serve on a jury and send a man to the chair, that's all right with you? At least it's right as long as there's somebody else to do the job. Let's face the facts, boy. You don't have the guts. I'd hate to think of you walking by the death house. The shop is where you belong. You can be nice and cozy there, wiring up fixtures and ringing the earth register. I can handle my duties without your help. It hurt me to say it. I had never talked like that to him before, and it hurt. The strange thing was that he didn't seem angry about it. He only looked at me puzzled. Is that all it is to you, he said, a duty? Yes. But you get paid for it, don't you? I get paid little enough for it. He kept looking at me that way. Only a duty, he said, and never took his eyes off me. But you enjoy it, don't you? That was the question he asked. You enjoy it, don't you? You stand there looking through a peephole in the wall at the chair. In 30 years, I have stood there more than 100 times looking at that chair. The guards bring somebody in. Usually he is in a daze. Sometimes he screams. He throws himself around and fights. Sometimes it is a woman. And a woman can be as hard to handle as a man when she is led to the chair. And sooner or later, whoever it is strapped down. And the black hood is dropped over his head, and now your hand is on the switch. And the warden signals. Pull the switch. The current hits the body like a tremendous rush of air suddenly filling it. The body leaps out of the chair with only the straps holding it back. The head jerks, and a curl of smoke comes from it. And you release the switch, and the body falls back again. And you do it once more. And you do it a third time, make sure. And whenever your hand presses the switch, you can see it in your mind, what the current is doing to that body, and what the face under the hood must look like. Enjoy it? That was the question my son asked me. That's what he said to me, as if I didn't have the same feelings deep down in me that we all have. Enjoy it? Oh my God. How could anyone not enjoy it?
The COI podcast is made possible through the generosity of donors to Conflict of Interest Theater Company and is available streaming on the web at conflicttheater.podomatic.com. You can also find us by searching for the COI podcast in the iTunes podcast directory. Read our blog at conflicttheater.blogspot.com. For more information on the company and its productions, visit us on the web at coitc.org. Graphic design is by Eunice Inquimboy. Legal advice, Paul Renitz. Special thanks to Gamze Ceylon, Ann Galloway, Jennifer Rathbone, Eileen Trilly, Jason Updike, and Sam Van Halgren. Questions, comments, and submissions can be sent to conflictinfo@gmail.com.